It's all the best part. But I am more than proud to introduce our speaker for this evening, Dave W. from Concord. Woo!
Hi, everybody. My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Can everybody hear me out there? Can you hear me?
Raise the mic closer.
Louder!
Raise the mic. The mic needs to be closer. There you go.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
No? Yeah?
Should we turn it if you
want? Oh, gosh. I want to say to Denise, thank you for asking me to share tonight. We'll see afterwards. You know, I was at the gym this morning, and some of my gym friends were asking me how I'm doing. I'm saying, you know, I'm just feeling a little anxious tonight, you know, because I'm going to be speaking at a meeting for 45 minutes. And one of them was so cute, she said, is there an intermission? and somebody else said, do they stop and ask questions and answers during it? I said, nope, it's just going to be 45 minutes straight. And, you know, it shouldn't be a problem speaking for 45 minutes because I'm always reminded the first time I ever chaired a meeting, I was about 9 months sober and I spoke for 45 minutes. The only issue with that, it was supposed to be a 15-minute chair. you know, and it was like 43 minutes of a drunkalogue and 2 minutes of recovery and... And I had old timers come up to me and say, Dave, you don't need to share your four step with us. And thanks for the drunkalogue. And that went on for a while. And then one day I was at a meeting and I was hearing somebody, you know, read how it works. And I heard those magical words, we share in a general way what happened, what it's like, and what it's like now. And, you know, that got me to okay. 15, 20 minutes is good, you know, and hopefully halfway through this share, I'll be able to get sober. You know, I came into these rooms a low-bottom drunk the last 6 years of my drinking. I was homeless and out in the streets. I was one of those guys that stood out on a street corner with a sign, I'll work for food, you know, and during those 6 years, I went through 11 programs, hundreds of detoxes and shelters. And it all started off at around the age of 13, splitting a six-pack with my buddies at the park that I hung out at in San Francisco on a Friday and Saturday night. You know, and I also like to talk about the feelings that I had when I was growing up. I was very insecure, had very low self-esteem, and had an overwhelming fear of people. And when I started drinking, all that magically went away. And basically what alcohol did for me was it gave me a feeling of okayness deep down inside. And I chased that for the next 18 years of my life. You know, and I never saw the progression of the disease. I never even thought I had a disease. And what that looked like back then was I would drink on a Friday and Saturday night. And when I woke up the next morning, I woke up with a hangover. And I found that magical cure for that hangover, which was to drink again. And slowly but surely, it went from Friday and Saturday nights to Friday, Saturday, Sundays. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Mondays. You know, and they talk about the invisible line in these rooms, and that invisible line was it went from wanting to drink to needing to drink, and I needed to drink 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And that happened at a very early age, probably in my 18 or 19 years old. You know, I growing up, you know, I always had an overwhelming need to have somebody take care of me. You know, and I found somebody, and her disease was she had an overwhelming need to take care of somebody. And it was kind of like a match. And believe me, it was not a match made in heaven, but it did keep us together for 3 years.
She said they can't hear back there.
No,
can you guys hear? Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. You know, and in this relationship, we ended up having a son together, and not knowing anything about the disease of alcoholism, she thought that San Francisco and everybody that I hung around with was the problem, and so she thought we should move out to Concord, and it sounded like a great idea to me, But like they say in the rooms, wherever you go, there you are. And I carried my alcoholic self right along with me. You know, and I was doing things, you know, and at this point, too, and some of you may or may not know, I work out at the ball games. I work at the Giants A's, back then the 49er games, Warrior games. And, you know, and when we were together, I had no idea what it was, what it meant to be in a relationship, you know. Any time that I was able to go to work, I kept all the money to myself. And when she worked, you know, she contributed to our relationship, to our family and stuff. And, you know, when we were living out in Concord, I'd be doing things like I'd be going back to San Francisco to drink with my buddies on a Friday and Saturday night. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I would call up a taxi cab to come pick me up and drive me home from San Francisco to Concord. And I'd be pounding on a door to have her come out and pay the taxi cab driver. And she would, you know, and she would. But a person could only put up with so much of this. And after about 6 months of this, she had enough of me and she threw me out. And that devastated me because this is the person who I thought was going to take care of me for the rest of my life. You know, so what I ended up doing then, what I did then was I moved back to the other person who I thought would take care of me for the rest of my life, which was back to mom's house. You know, and the disease had progressed to where I had become totally dysfunctional. I couldn't go to work even if I wanted to go to work. You know, and when my mom took me in, you know, what I basically did there was I locked myself in my bedroom. There, it was me, a little 5-inch portable black and white TV, and my bed. My mom couldn't have any alcohol around the house because I would find it and drink it. She had to put locks on her bedroom door because I constantly went into her bedroom to steal money to go drink with. you know, and after about 9 months of this, she finally had enough of me and she threw me out. And that started the next 6 years of being homeless and out in the streets. You know, and just a little plug for Al-Anon. When I was about a year sober, you know, I realized how devastating that must have been for my mom, to, you know, to endure me for 9 months, for the 9 months. And I just thought, you know, gosh, she had the courage to finally say no and throw me out. And I asked her, Mom, where did you get the courage to finally say no? She said she went to one Al-Anon meeting. right? Right? Yeah. Thank God for Al-Anon, right? You know, but that started the next 6 years of being homeless and out in the streets, you know, and you know, there's a part in the big book where it says the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one, you know, and for the next 6 years, it just felt like this was normal for me. You know, I was going in and out of shelters, in and out of detoxes. I went through 11 programs, you know, and another thing that was happening during those 6 years was I was getting picked up for a lot of drunken publics. And what they would do basically would, you know, they would pick me up off the streets, throw me in a drunk tank, and they would release me and they would give me a court date. And back then, going to court was not one of my top priorities. So after about 13 or 14 of these, you know, they, instead of holding me for four hours, they ended up holding me for 6 months. You know, and during that time, though, I remember standing in front of the judge, and he said 6 months in county jail. And I remember thinking to myself, yes, I deserve this. But the reason why I thought I deserved it was because I didn't show up for court. I didn't know that the reason why I had to go to court was because of my drinking. I never made that connection that drinking was the issue that I had. You know, and back then too, a lot of the county jails were full, so they put me into this work furlough place in Richmond, where guys get to go to work during the day and they have to come back at night, but not for me. But what they did say was, you know, if you go to this alcohol program, it was called a DUCE program in jail. Once you complete it, we'll release you. So I said, okay, that sounded great. So I was doing this dues program, you know, and living in this work furlough place. And about 1 week prior to me completing this program, they gave me a day pass. What I did was I went back to my son's mom's house because my mom was there, her mom was there, and you know, my son was there, and there were other people there. And I went back there, and I remember sitting in the house, and I needed to drink. Now, they wouldn't trust me to go out to the store or anything like that because they knew what I was going to do. So what I did was I went into her bathroom, and it was a big bottle of Listerine, and I drank it down. The next thing that I knew, I woke up in Martinez jail. I had no idea what happened after I drank that. What they told me was that, you know, I was just passed out. I was, I don't know, doing some a bunch of crazy stuff, and then they called the police, and the police came and got me. And I look back at that as one of the biggest blessings in my life. Because I remember sitting in that jail, and I called up my dad, and I asked my dad if he would put me, you know, on another program's list again. Because back then, you know, you get on a program's list, and it would take about 3 or 4 months before you were able to get in. You know, and so what ended up happening for me was I had to do the rest of my time, the rest of the 6 months. And I did it out in Clayton at Marsh Creek County Jail. You know, and what I had to do was I had to write the program every single week because I couldn't call. They wouldn't let me to call. So I wrote the program every single week. And then finally, what I thought was going to happen was that I was going to, once I got released, I would be able to go into the program. But it wasn't my time yet. And I remember this big bus taking us down to Concord BART to drop us off. That's where they would release us. You know, and I remember getting released there at Concord BART at 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. So at 5 minutes after six, I was at the liquor store drinking again. You know, and that started the next venture of being in a tenderloin, and you know, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse for me. You know, and I believe in angels, so to speak, through people. And so when I got out, I still had a call day. I still had to call once a week. I think it was on Wednesday for me. I had to call them once a week. And one of the weeks that I was supposed to call, because if you didn't make that call, you'd be dropped off the list and you'd go to the bottom of the list. And I remember the day that I was supposed to call, I was picked up for drunk in public and I was in jail and I couldn't call. And I remember being released at 4 o'clock in the morning or something to that extent. And I made my way to Concord, went to Concord Detox. It was the next day and I called up, you know, to let him know what happened and everything. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, you know, sorry, Dave, we took your name off the list. And that you were dropped down to the bottom of the list. And I remember how devastated I was. Not that I was going to get sober or anything, but, but you know, that gosh, I wanted to get into that program, maybe just to get off the streets or something. You know, and I told him what had happened, and he said, don't worry, Dave, I'm going to put you back on the list where you were at. And at that point, I was like number two on the list. And it was like, thank you, thank you. And I look back at things like that. You know, I was at a meeting the other night, and they talked about, the topic was moments, you know, that helped your sobriety and early recovery. And those were one of those moments, because I don't know if I would have been able to make it if I would have went back on the list and had to go back out in the streets for another 3 or 4 months. But what ended up happening in that detox was I stayed there for about 4 or 5 days. And then I got, you know, kicked out. Not kicked out, but I had to leave. And, you know, once again, you know, I didn't know where to go, didn't know what to do. So I remember this church up in Clayton. They helped me out before with like food vouchers and things, hotel vouchers and things like that. So I walked from Concord all the way up to Clayton, and it was like a Saturday morning, December 7th, 1991. It was a Saturday morning, and I remember knocking on the door and told them, you know, I'm homeless, can you help me? And there was actually nobody there to help me. But this one guy said, you know, I'll see what I can do. So he came out, he gave me a motel voucher for one night, and he gave me $20 cash. once again, you know, not a good thing for an alcoholic. So I remember going down to the hotel room. With that $20, of course, I went and bought a quart of vodka at the liquor store next door. Passed out, woke up the next day, having people, you gotta leave, you gotta leave. And then, you know, I still had some money left, and I made my way down to this park, you know, and once again, and I'm going through severe withdrawals at this point too, really severe withdrawals. And I remember that night I needed something for my withdrawals, and what I did was I went to the liquor store and I bought a cold pack of beer. And what I did was, you know, I was sleeping in this bathroom in this park, and what I did was I drank two beers every hour to that next morning. You know, that helped me get me through the withdrawals, because when I was going through withdrawals, there would be like 3 or 4 days of going through some severe withdrawals from alcohol. You know, and I remember waking up that next morning, it was December 9th, 1991. When I woke up that morning, I had no idea it was going to be the last day that I was going to drink. I had no idea that my life was going to take such a profound change I couldn't imagine before in my life. What happened that morning was I called a Pittsburgh detox, and they told me to come in. So I ended up taking a bus out to Pittsburgh detox. And when I got out there, they said, Dave, since you're really close of getting into a program, you can stay here until they come and get you. And I said, okay, that'll be great. I ended up staying in that detox for 25 days. And then the program finally came and got me. You know, and when I went out to this program, you know, they say in the rooms how it works is to be honest, open, and willing. And when I went out there, I don't know where it came from, but the open and the willingness was there. The honesty part came a little bit later. You know, what I mean by that was when I went out there, they said, Dave, if you're going to be here, we want you to do this, 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 and this. And what came out of my mouth was, okay, 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 and okay. And basically what they were saying was the same thing that they were saying every single time I went into a program, which was, Dave, if you're going to be here, we want you to get a sponsor, we want you to get a big book, we want you to go to meetings, and we want you to work the steps. And the way that I used to process that before would be, okay, let me think about that one, and I don't need to do those other ones. You know, and I heard in early recovery that sobriety is a gift. God will give it to us when we're ready. You know, and I just wasn't ready before. I just wasn't ready. And in that moment, I just kind of knew that I was ready. And I truly believe that we're all blessed with the moment of clarity. And mine came when I was about maybe 3 weeks into that program. And I was reading in chapter 3 about more about alcoholism. And when I read that paragraph, it hit me like a ton of bricks. You know, it was my moment of clarity. And what it talked about is that the illusion that someday, somehow, we'll be able to enjoy and control our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And many pursue it in the gates of insanity or death. And when I read that, I can clearly see what was going on in the previous 6 years of my life, that every single time I'd go through this 3 or 4 day withdrawal from alcohol, there was always this thought in my mind, Dave, it's going to be different. Dave, it's going to be different. And I truly believed it in my heart that it was going to be different. And what I couldn't see was that every single time I picked up that first drink, I was off and running again. That next paragraph said that we had to concede to our innermost selves that were real alcoholics, and for the first time in my life, I finally admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had become unmanageable. And the biggest difference for me was it went from here to here. You know, and recovery started for me at that point. You know, a lot of stuff happened for the 4 months that I was out there. I'd gotten a sponsor. I was going to meetings every single day. I was working the steps. You know, and another profound thing that happened to me was when I was about 3 weeks out in that program, somebody gave me this little 24-hour book. And the next morning, I started waking up at 5:30 in the morning and reading this 24-hour book. And if there has been one thing that has been consistent throughout my recovery, besides not drinking, is waking up at 5:30 and reading a meditation book and doing some meditation. You know, it doesn't matter where I'm at. If I go on vacations, I bring my books with me. You know, and I don't know what it was about that, but it just brought some joy in my heart to be able to get up and start reading something. So anyway, I ended up staying in that program for 4 months. And when I left there, what happened for me for those 4 months, I had built a foundation for recovery, you know, and I carried that with me. You know, and I ended up getting my job back, working out at the game, a job that was highly, highly impossible to get fired from. Because if you showed up, you showed up. If you didn't, you didn't have to call in sick or anything. And I found a way, not once, but twice, to get fired from it. You know, and that's alcoholism. And I ended up getting that job back, and I'm so grateful that I got that job back. Because basically what I did was, for the first 2 years of my recovery, I lived at the Concord Fellowship. You know, I started going to the morning meetings. If it was a night game, I'd go to the morning meeting and the noon meetings. If it was a day game, I'd go to the morning meetings and the night meetings. And back then, the Concord Fellowship was open all day. And basically what we did was we played cards all day. You know, and I needed that. I needed that fellowshipping with other guys that were sober, you know. And, you know, the other thing, that just a lot of stuff that happened to me. You know, I remember my first 2 years of recovery, I would whine about everything. You know, just whine and whine, just trivial stuff, trivial, just little things. I'd be whining, you know, and one day I was whining to my sponsor about something, and he just looked at me and said, "Dave, do you want to be happy?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Go ahead." you know, and it has taken me a long time that, you know, that I'm responsible for my happiness. I'm responsible for my happiness, you know, and at around 7 years of sobriety, I truly believed that I was affected by the disease of alcoholism long before I picked up that first drink. I was affected by my dad's drinking growing up, and at around 7 years of sobriety, a lot of that stuff that I had drank down that I never dealt with started surfacing for me around my dad's drinking. There was a lot of emotional and physical abuse that was growing up in that alcoholic home. And what I did at that point was I got into another 12-step program and I sought outside help. And at that point, you know, I felt like I went through a year of grief for that boy that that grew up in that alcoholic home. There was a lot of sadness that was deep down inside me that came up. And there was a lot of anger deep down inside me that I didn't know that would start surfacing too. You know, and I remember one day I was driving home from a friend's house in Sacramento, and I am bawling from the deepest part of my soul, just crying and crying and crying and crying. And I kept thinking to myself, where's all this coming from? Where's all this coming from? And every single time I thought about my dad, I just started crying and crying and crying and crying. And then all of a sudden, in this moment, I felt forgiveness like I have never felt before for another human being. You see, for the first 7 years of my recovery, I knew in my head that my dad did the best that he knew how. In that moment, I knew in my heart that he did the best that he knew how. And because of that, I was able to have this amazing love affair with this man for the next 18 years of his life until he passed away about 7 years ago. You know, and that has probably been one of the biggest blessings that I've gotten in recovery, to be able to heal from that deep wound. You know, I remember hearing something recently that, you know, we do not live in a world that is broken beyond repair. We live in a world that is wounded and in need of healing. You know, and when I came into recovery, I had a lot of deep wounds. A lot of deep wounds, and I wasn't broken beyond repair, though. I was wounded and in need of healing, and I had found so much healing in Alcoholics Anonymous and 12 Steps of Recovery, my relationship with God. You know, at around, you know, I've had a lot of profound experiences with the power of prayer, you know, and at around, it was about 17 years ago, right around this time too, you know, I was in a relationship, and at that point, I hit what I describe as an emotional bottom in recovery. And it came in the form of the ending of a relationship. And, you know, I remember, gosh, being in relationships, you know, unconsciously looking for reasons why it's not going to work. Why it's not going to work, why it's not going to work. And I remember being in this relationship, and right on cue, 3 months, it's not going to work, it's not going to work. It was like, no, you got to stay, you got to stay. This is going to be good, this is going to be good. You know, the thing about this being in this relationship, though, was I had no idea what was going on inside of me. You know, I wanted to stay, but I had no idea how to deal with what was going on inside me. So it'd be like, you know, she'd be asking me, how you doing, Dave? I'm fine. I'm fine. You know, and I'm freaking dying inside. I am dying inside, and I don't know how to deal with this. And every single time I'd be saying, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'd put up this invisible wall. This invisible wall. You know, and after about a year, you know, she just couldn't deal with it anymore, and the relationship ended. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, unless I deal with this, it's not going to be different with the next relationship. And it was like, okay, God, I'm ready to deal with this. You know, let's do the deal. I'll give it 2 weeks. you know, little did I know it was going to take a long time for that to heal. You know, and during this time, you know, there was a lot of 3 o'clock in the morning wake-ups, curled up in a ball, bawling my eyes out, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, God, I can't do this. I can't do this. And this little voice would come in to me and say, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And that would give me a little bit of strength, you know, and more 3 o'clock in the morning wake-ups, bawling my eyes, gut-wrenching tears. God, I can't do this. God, I can't do this. Little voice would come, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Oh, shut up. Leave me alone. I can't do this. Jeez. And then I heard the voice that I needed to hear, which was, Dave, I need you to be able to walk through this so you can help other people down the road. You know, in the promises it says, we will see how our experience will benefit others. And I knew in my heart that if I didn't walk through this, that I wouldn't be able to stand with the other people that were going to go through the same thing. And since then, it's amazing how many people have come to me with the same issue. And I'm able to stand with them. you know, in this relationship with my dad, let me backtrack a little bit. During this time, too, you know, I was working out at the games, you know, and this deep healing is going on all this time, you know, and I was working a Giants game one night, and, you know, I'm just feeling this deep grief, and back then I did a souvenir stand in front of the stadium, you know, and I'm just thinking to myself, I just need to get home. I just need to get home. And back then, you know, we would close the souvenir stand when the game started. We would push it in. And so we pushed it in, and I'm like, I'm just needing to get home. You know, and I get out to my car, and my car has a flat tire. Now, normally a flat tire wouldn't be a big deal, but in the state that I was on, it just felt like another boulder on top of me. You know, so what I did was I called up AAA. AAA came out and fixed the tire, you know, and I'm getting into my car and I'm just praying to God, God, just give me some kind of sign. Just give me some kind of sign, God. You know, just give me some kind of sign. And I get into my car and I'm getting on Bay Bridge and I'm driving over the Bay Bridge and I'm praying, God, just give me some kind of sign. Give me some kind of sign. And I'm coming down off the Bay Bridge, coming down, you know, and God, just give me some kind of sign. And all of a sudden, I'm down off the end of the Bay Bridge, and I look up, and there's this big neon flashing sign, and it says, believe. Like, oh my gosh, God, wow, thank you. You know, little did I know that was for the Warriors when they were on their Believe tour. But it was so profound for me in that moment that, you know, that I knew the presence of God was with me. You know, it didn't take away the pain because that was something that I was going to have to walk through. But I knew that the presence of God was with me. You know, it was a little bit over 20 years ago. I remember I was at the gym and I heard this couple say, we can't wait till we retire so we can start traveling. And I remember hearing that, wait till we retire? Gosh, that's a long ways off. So what I ended up doing back then was I bought this timeshare. And every February I go to Hawaii. And I remember, you know, I was doing that for a few years. And I remember thinking to myself, gosh, I should go somewhere, you know, when the season ends. You know, and I've never been to Mexico, and I thought, you know what, I should go to Mexico. You know, I'll go to Cabo San Lucas. I've never been there. So I went, flew out to Cabo San Lucas, and I remember getting to the resort, and some other people there, you know, I was talking to them, and they said, you know, if you go down to this market, and if you buy your food and stuff there, it's a lot cheaper than buying it at the resort. And I thought, well, you know, it sounded like a great idea. So that night, I'm going to, you know, go to the market. And so I'm talking to the guys that were working out in front of the resort. You know, how do you get to the market? And they said, you know, you go down here and you just catch this bus and it'll take you to the market. But they also said, you know, don't veer too far outside the area. And I kind of took that with a grain of salt, you know, threw it in the back of my mind. So I get on this old school bus, you know, because that's the kind of buses they have over there, you know, and they take me down to this market, and, you know, I come out with about 3 or 4 bags of water, and I get back on another bus, and, you know, and I'm going back toward the resort, and I kind of, like, look back, wow, that kind of looked like my stop, and the bus just kept going and going and going and going. And then all of a sudden, the bus driver stops and he says, everybody get off the bus. You know, this is the last stop. And I look around and I'm the only one on the bus. So I get off the bus. I have no idea where I'm at, right? No idea where I'm at. And then I start, you know, walking. And I'm walking down this really, really dark alley. And then all of a sudden, what those guys said at the resort popped to the front of my mind. Don't veer too far outside the area. So I'm walking down these dark alleys, kind of streets, and I'm looking at every street corner, and there's these non-spiritual people hanging out on the corners. And my heart is starting to pound. It's starting to pound. And, you know, it just seems like the streets are getting smaller, the streets are getting darker. The people on the corner, they're appearing more non-spiritual to me. And I'm praying. I'm praying, God, help me. Help me, God. You know, and I turn this corner, and I like, and my heart's pounding. I'm pounding, you know, in fear. And like, oh my gosh, God, help me, help me. All of a sudden, in the corner of my eye, this little light flashing down this hut kind of house caught the corner of my eye, and I turn around and I look, And underneath that little light, there's a round circle with a triangle in it. And it says, AA meeting here. I'm like, oh my gosh, wow. I walked in there, and I got to tell you, it felt like the first time when I walked into a meeting. I felt safe, and I felt like at home. There was one guy in there, Spanish speaking, you know, and I know enough Spanish to get by. You know, and he said, you know, I told him what had happened and everything, and he goes, why don't you stick around? There's going to be a meeting here in 15 minutes. I said, great. You know, and it's about four other guys came in. We have this meeting. I have no idea what they're saying because they're talking really fast in Spanish. But I ended up talking to one of the guys after the meeting, and he says, you know, he goes, I know exactly where your resort at. I'll give you a ride. And he had this little scooter. And I'm in the back of the scooter with these bags of water, and we're jetting through Mexico, and he takes me to my resort, and he says, you know, there's an English-speaking meeting just two blocks right down the road. And so, okay, I was at that meeting every day for the rest of the week. You know, but I share this because, you know, there's a part in the big book. It says, the purpose of this book is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. You know, and I remember hearing this early in recovery, too, that, you know, God led me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous led me to God. And I got to say that drinking is not the most important thing in my life. Not drinking is the most important thing in my life today. The most important thing in my life today is my relationship with my higher power. You know, because without God, none of this is possible. None of this is possible. You know, I was able to have this amazing relationship with my father. My son, who was 7 years old, just turned 40 yesterday. He came over the night before. My girlfriend was there. I was there. We had this birthday cake, you know, and he brought over a friend and his little dog. And, you know, we have this amazing relationship, you know. He's one of us. But I know how to take care of myself around him, you know. And because, you know, of his issues, well, my issues with his issues, I should say. you know, we've never been on a trip together, you know. And I remember thinking, it's time. So we're going to go to Hawaii in February, you know. And he is so stoked because he's never gone. You know, and these are some of the gifts that I've gotten in recovery. I don't know how much time I have left, but you know, when my dad passed away 7 years ago, you know, I remember that, you know, I was out at the ballpark. You know, it was in March, so I was out there getting, you know. We were getting ready to get to set up the souvenir stand to get ready for opening day and stuff. And I remember getting a phone call that he had passed away. And I remember just being numb and in a bit of shock. And my dad lived in Merced. And I remember the next day driving down to Merced to take care of everything, you know, around his passing. And I remember the feeling that I had when I was driving down there, my heart was brimming with gratitude. Not gratitude that he had passed away, but gratitude for this program that healed my heart and healed my relationship with my dad. And I was able to have this amazing love affair with my dad. Because I was thinking, how many times did I go down and visit my dad in Merced? Hundreds of times. Hundreds of times, because I love spending time with him. I also knew what my limit was, too. 4 or 5 days, gotta go. Gotta go. I learned that in Al-Anon. you know, but like I said, you know, my heart was brimming with gratitude, you know, and you know, this is the holidays, and I don't know if anybody needs to hear this, but the holidays can feel lonely at times, you know, especially in early recovery. You know, and this is one of those other profound prayer situations that I had. you know, it was about maybe 8 or 9 years ago. I remember I was feeling this deep, deep sense of loneliness deep down inside me. And it wasn't like, you know, well, go be with people and stuff, because I have hundreds of friends in recovery. I'm around tens of thousands of people at work when I'm working out there. This was coming from another deeper place, another deep wound that was healing inside of me, you know, and it was just bringing up a lot of loneliness, a lot of deep loneliness. And I remember it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the freeway driving to work, and I was praying to God, God, I need a sign. God, I need some kind of sign. Please, God, help me with my loneliness. Help me with my loneliness. And back then, I was doing a souvenir stand up in the third deck. And a friend had texted me, you know, I was sitting down. A friend had texted me. She said, Dave, how you doing? And I'm responding to her, I'm just feeling this overwhelming sense of loneliness. And just about when I'm ready to press send, these two young girls come up to the stand. And, you know, I put the phone down and, you know, can I help you and stuff? Yeah, can we see that? Can we see that? Sure. But on the corner of my eye, this girl has a tattoo on her arm. And I have never, ever asked anybody, you know, what their tattoo says. And out of curiosity, I guess I asked her, what does your tattoo say? She turned over her arm and it said, you are not alone. Like, oh my gosh, God, wow. I showed them the text and we're like, hallelujah. You know, and what I experienced in that moment was I felt that loneliness, but I did not feel alone, if that makes sense. I felt that loneliness that was repressed deep down inside me, but I didn't feel alone, you know, and I don't know if any of you are feeling lonely, but I can promise you that your higher power is with you. Truly grateful to be of service tonight. Happy holidays to all of you, and thank you.
Hey, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you.